In 1981, Tommy joined the MIT faculty, succeeding his friend and colleague David Marr, who had sadly died so young. Tommy is now Eugene McDermott Professor in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences and at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's also a co-director of the Center for Biological and Computational Learning and was appointed investigator immediately after the establishment of the McGovern Institute in 2000. Tommy is a foreign member of the Italian Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His papers span mathematics, computer science, neuroscience. His main contributions are in computer and biological vision, computational neuroscience, system theory, and computer graphics. His current focus is on learning in terms of the underlying mathematics, its engineering applications, and its role for understanding object recognition and visual cortex. Today, he will give us a sketch of the visual cortex. Tommy, it's great to have you here. Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Axel. Can you hear me? Is this active? Yeah. Yes. Okay. Thanks a lot for the invitation, and I will tell you about recent work that is kind of a consequence of work on a model of visual cortex that Gabriel spoke about in the first minutes of his talk. It's work that has been going on in my group for the last 10 plus years, a lot of people involved, including Gabriel. But before that, let me tell you a very brief assessment of where we stand in terms of trying to understand intelligence and trying to understand the brain. I think after 50 years of artificial intelligence, mainly because of progress in machine learning, we're finally seeing a number of systems that are as good or almost as good as we are in narrow domains of intelligence. These are playing chess, responding at difficult questions, Jeopardy, essentially driving a car, Mobileye. But the problem, the full problem of intelligence is not solved, of course. And my personal bet is that if we want to get there, if we want to have a system that passes a full Turing test, we'll have first to understand the human brain at some of the levels of understanding. And this is partly because the Turing test itself is a definition not of intelligence, but a definition of human intelligence. So, sorry for the confusion of this slide. I guess the projector makes some interesting editing. But vision is a complex problem, one of the aspects of intelligence. The ventral stream is what Gabriel already mentioned, so I'm going to go very fast here. Okay, thank you. Anyway, I can skip most of it because Gabriel spoke about it already. So this model we've been working on for the last 10 years. It's a model with just an example of many models of the feed-forward path in the ventral stream, starting really with Hubel and Wiesel. Fukushima was the main the main person who really put the Hubel and Wiesel idea in a quantitative framework with the neocognitron. And since then, there have been a lot of different contributions. This particular model that we started to develop with Max Riesenhuber and then Thomas Serre is just an example of these feed-forward models of visual cortex. It accounts for a number of physiology data, predicts some. This is a list I don't at all want to go you to go through. It is just to mention that there are a number of things is the model is consistent with. It also predicts, in quotation mark, performance human subjects for tasks like rapid categorization, in which the rapid presentation of images followed by a mask forces the observer probably to use just a feed-forward path without the ability of changing fixation or shifting attention. It also, and the agreement with human performance is roughly consistent with it at a level of about 80% performance in this kind of Simon Thorpe tasks. More surprising things is that it works well compared to state-of-the-art computer vision systems in detecting different types of objects in natural scenes. This has been done on databases like Caltech 101 and many other ones. It also leads to systems like this one that we use in different labs for phenotyping the behavior of mice, mutant mice, and the effect of drugs. It recognizes different type of behaviors after training with video clips. And it works also at roughly at human level performance. So the question is why, apart from the fact of whether it's a correct model of a part of the visual system, the feed-forward path, the question is why does it work as well as it does? It's simple. It is in a sense a very trivial model. When I started working on it, I thought let's try this kind of Hubel and Wiesel model, show that they don't work on natural images, and let's go on to something more interesting. But in fact, they work surprisingly well, and after 10 years, I was not yet able to understand why. There are various intuitions, but very difficult to be able to say, for instance, what is the optimal number of layers, under which conditions, and so on and so forth. The point is that we need models are fine, but beyond models, one really needs theory for a fuller understanding. And so what I'll tell you about is a theory which, if true, would be quite interesting. So if true. The motivation for it is the basic assumption that the main task the ventral stream is doing is to get for each image or each object in an image a signature. You can think of it as a vector of features that is as invariant as possible to geometric transformations of the image. The reason is that I think that the complexity of object recognition, for instance, in recognizing, say, a cat versus a dog after having seen one example of a cat or a dog or a few examples, is not so much the variability within the classes of dogs and cats, because this will give you perhaps how many different dogs? Thousands types of dogs? From a single dog, you can get probably in the around 100 million or more distinguishable images. So the argument, this is just a motivation argument, is not a theorem, is that the complexity of object recognition comes from geometric transformation, translation, scale, rotations. Another motivation, kind of computational experiment, is the following. Let's take images of dogs and horses, And let's assume I have a classifier trained on pixels, and I train with one image of a dog or one image of a horse, and then I test on other images, and I find that the performance is essentially 50% chance. However, if I normalize first, I have an oracle that normalizes the images for the geometric transformation, so they're always presented from the same point of view, at the same distance and position, then even training with one example gives me a performance on pixels of around 70%, and much better with a few more examples. So this is the conjecture of what the ventral stream is doing. It's trying to provide a vector, let's call it a signature, that is then used as an entry to a classifier or more generally an associative memory for recognition. And this signature should be invariant to geometric transformations. Okay, so I don't have enough time, and this theory so far is as three parts. I'll give you only a few key points here. The first part essentially shows that there is a simple model based on using dot products, which is assumed one of the biologically fundamental units of computation. So essentially inputs to the synaptic weight of a neuron. Uses this to achieve invariance for to geometric transformations for new objects by memorizing any object and its transformation during development. So, for instance, a baby who stores the frames of the movies of a movie in which the face of the mother translates and looms and rotates. That's enough to get invariance to any other objects in the future, to the same transformations. So this first part is essentially shows that a hierarchical architecture is the best way to get this kind of invariance. The second part shows that if instead of memorizing images of this movie during development, which is biologically more plausible, is online learning through Hebbian synapses of these frames, then you can predict the receptive fields, the tuning properties of various cells in the visual pathway, including simple cells, and that is one of the things I want to speak about. And the third part is another series of predictions about class-specific modules in the visual cortex, like, for instance, face patches, as found by Doris Tsao and Werner Freiwald. So these are some of the questions that the theory answers. Whether the answers are correct, that depends on whether the theory is correct. And it's probably too nice to be correct. I say that from the beginning. It's a bit like in physics, starting from symmetry properties, conservation laws, and predicting equation of motion and so on, which it seems to be, to me, kind of unrealistic to imagine is true for the brain. But anyway. So it's, for instance, it would explain why there are Gabor tuning curves in visual cortex. It would explain this kind of interesting property that I was not aware until a few months ago. These are papers by Jones and Palmer, Dario Ringach, and Chris Neal, and Mike Stryker, in which they show that receptive fields in simple cells in the mouse, the cat, and the macaque are all well approximated by Gabor functions. And in a Gabor function is the essentially the product of a sinusoid and a Gaussian. And in order to have a Gabor wavelet, you have to have this property that the wave, the lambda, the wavelength of the sinusoid is proportional to the sigma of the Gaussian. That's not trivial at all. And and they found out that's roughly correct for these three species, that the constant of proportionality is roughly the same, that the sigma in the y direction, which is the one orthogonal to the modulation, is roughly square root of 2 larger than the sigma in the direction of the modulation. All these parameters are kind of summarized in this plot of NY versus NAX with macaque, cat, and mouse falling more or less consistently with each other. So, okay, these are the questions I'll try to answer. Now, let me start with this observation that in order to do recognition, you don't need a generative model. You need you don't need to store every pixel. You need to take a number of measurements on the image. There was a time in which OCR was done by having a pre-chosen and then fixed set of random lines, and then counting intersections with a character for each one of these lines. This gave you a feature vector that was sufficient for recognition of digits. Now, the suggestion from neuroscience is that a natural way to take measurements on the images by neurons in the visual pathway are dot products, where X could be the input to a neuron, could be a vector of photoreceptors, and T in this case would be the synaptic weights to a neuron. So if we take this view, the signature of an image at, say, one layer is a set of dot products. You can think of T1, T2, and so on as the tuning of each neuron, so the synaptic weights of a number of neurons. And we want to look how to get a signature which is invariant to a fine transformation in R2 on the plane. So you have translations, and you have rotation, scaling, and combination thereof. Okay, so suppose that what it's done during development, say in the biological case, by the system, is to get one image. Let's call it a template. When I say image, it could be image or could be neural image after some processing, for instance, by the retina. One image, let's say T1, and then transformations of it. As I said, for instance, the movie of a face of the mother, you know, translating. So there will be different frames, and G0, G1, GG would be, in this case, just different translations of the original image, T1, and you store all of this and of other template. So, okay, so then the claim is that if I take averages over these transformations of linear or nonlinear functions of these dot products, I get a quantity which is invariant to the transformation. Okay, intuitively, the fact is this, that I can take, say, my face, this is a template, I do a dot product. Now, if my face translates, I will get different values for these dot products. Suppose this set of transformation is closed, then if my face stays and instead I have translation of the template, I'll get the same set of numbers in a different order. So this says that I can get invariance to translation of a face that I've seen only once just by having translations of a template, which are used the first time and afterwards. So a vector of features obtained in this way is an invariant signature for these transformations. And this is a very simple recipe for getting invariance in essentially one layer. And this corresponds, you can think of it as a complex cells doing this kind of average over simple cells in the case of U1. You want more, however, than just global invariance to a fine transformation. I want, for instance, to have invariance Anybody who can help? Okay. Good. I want to have invariance not only to translation, say, of this phase. I want also to have invariance to local transformations, so diffeomorphisms. And in order to have this, this, by the way, has to do with whole and parts. I want to be able to recognize the whole face, and to recognize individual parts, and to have tolerance about their relations. So in order to have this, one can show that a hierarchical network, like we may have in visual cortex, with essentially receptive fields that are larger and larger as you go from the input to the output, can achieve this dual goal of global invariance and local invariance to diffeomorphisms. I'll not get into this because it will take too much time, but the conclusion is that we can get this invariance to affine transformations and tolerance to local deformations by using a hierarchical architecture based on these dot products and on storing during development neural images of transformations. Now, I want to go to probably, for most of you, the more interesting part, which is based on this additional assumptions that instead of storing all in a batch mode, all the images during development of, say, one object or a few objects, what is stored is what happens is online learning with Hebbian synapses. Now, Hebbian synapses, in which the change in the synaptic weights is essentially proportional to the product of input and output plus a normalization term, is equivalent to the Hoyer flow, which is an online algorithm for computing principal components, so the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix of the inputs. And so from this, the conclusion is, if this is what's happening, the tuning, for instance, of simple cells, and then afterwards in other areas, will be dictated by the top principal components of the template book, the images stored during development. So now we are led to the following question. Suppose I'm a simple cell. Suppose I'm looking at the world through a Gaussian, two-dimensional Gaussian window, say synaptic distribution of synapses. And then I have images just translating, for instance, that I see through this Gaussian window. What are the principal components of this set of inputs? This leads to an equation in which is an eigenvalue equation, where this ty minus x, t is the autocorrelation of the images. G are Gaussian windows with the sigma. This is a one-dimensional version of the equation. So I'm looking for the eigenfunction of this with T being, as I said, the autocorrelation. We know that the Fourier transform of this autocorrelation, the power spectrum of natural images, is 1 over F squared, roughly. So we have some information of this type. There are not many parameters here. And we can say a few things. There are a number of eigenvectors, and there are other things I will tell you. We can show that the eigenvectors, the eigenfunction, cannot be given in analytical form, but they are very similar to Gabor functions or Hermite functions. And they look like this. For different sigmas from top to down, and the first eigenvectors on the left, the second one on the middle, and the third one on the right, the sinus and the cosinus. In 2D, they look like this, so they look very much like simple cells. These are two different sigma and different eigenvectors. And in fact, if you, both from theory, but these are numerical simulations, you can see that that the theory predictions are not only qualitatively, but quantitatively very much in agreement with this experimental data from the mouse, the cat, and the monkey. These are the red cross are the theory, the other ones are the experimental data. The axes are essentially the number of cycles that you see under the Gaussian envelope in the physiological data in the x direction and the y direction. And it's interesting we get quantitative agreement with almost no parameters, and these results are rather insensitive to what we assume about the autocorrelation, which is the only parameter, so to speak, in the eigenvalue equation. And we have also, but I will not speak about it, prediction about what happens at higher levels in other areas in V1, in ventral stream. How much time do I have?
Like 8 more minutes.
Okay, so let me speak about another prediction of this, because this is fun. So one can show that you can have perfect invariance by using the kind of scheme approach that I sketched to affine transformations. Now, fine transformation in R2. You cannot have invariance to, for instance, rotations in depth. Okay? from one image. However, for certain classes of objects, like faces and other ones, the same approach can give you approximate invariance for non-affine transformations, like change of expression, like rotation in depth, and so on. If you do the following, if your template that you have stored during, say, what I call the developmental phase is, for instance, is one instance of the same class of objects. So if you learn essentially how faces rotate from one face, then you can apply this, the resulting templates, to other faces and do pretty well. So for instance, if on top of this HMAX model we have units that are tuned to, so this is during learning, during development, you store images that are one face, different views, then by using those as templates for the dot products, you can get a system that is pretty good at being quasi-invariant to rotation in depth. So here, what you see is recognition performance, a measure of recognition performance of individual faces. So the training is one face at some viewpoint, like a frontal view, and then you are testing for other viewpoints, and the distractors are other faces, and you can see that if you have this additional layer in the model, you get much better performance beyond, say, 30 or 20 degrees of rotation that you get otherwise. So now there is this puzzle of one puzzle in what Wienrich and Doris found in the macaque face patches. They found different face patches, and there are more neurons that seems to be especially tuned to faces. And in particular, they found this area, which is ML and MF, which seems to be, with neurons, that seems to be depending, the tuning depending on the view. And then they found AM, the most anterior one, where they found neurons that seems to be tuned to individual faces invariant to view, like the output of our model. In between, they have this area AL, where I'll show you in a second, where they found cells that, if they have a peak for a certain view, they have a peak for the symmetric view, say minus 45, plus 45. Why that? Why this mirror symmetric neurons? Okay. So from our point of view, the question is, suppose you have the view tuning, then you have this stage to give you more invariance to different views. And the mathematical question is, if you have a set of vectors, and then you have also the mirror symmetric one. So you have a vector representing a face like this. You have also a vector for the face like this. So if you have one, you have the other. What is the properties of the eigenvectors, of the PCA, the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix, of a matrix with this structure? It turns out that they are odd and even eigenvectors, functions in general. So if you take the square of that, you'll get always symmetric peaks. And so on the left, you see the physiology in AL, one neuron with two symmetric peaks for two different views. And on the right, you see the response of neurons in our model, which correspond to the first four eigenfunctions of this covariance matrix. So this mirror symmetry would come here because of the computation, because the tuning of these neurons are PCA of views seen during development or during learning. So let me finish here, maybe a couple of minutes early, which is good, is since there is lunch now, if this were true, and this is a big, big if, then this would almost suggest that you can infer some basic properties of not only what cortex is doing, but also properties of neurons, like tuning properties, from symmetry considerations, from invariance in this case to translation scaling and rotations. This is like a dream, but let's say this way. For now, it's a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tommy, for this beautiful talk. We have time for questions for lunch. Bye.
What if I go to a virtual reality environment where the physics is different? And instead of having rigid objects, which are subject to affine transformations, I have non-rigid objects. And I can imagine myself in an environment like a Salvador Dali painting, where you have new invariances, and I'm pretty sure I'd be able to learn those. But how would the simple cells look like in my brain? I would have to learn something new, I guess.
Well, in fact, that's exactly the right question. One of the main predictions of the theory would be that I did not show you a few theorems, but it turns out that the type of features encoded by the cells are not very important, unlike the common wisdom, in computer vision and so on, if you have enough of them. What is important is the transformation to which you want to be invariant and to which you are exposed during development. So one of the predictions here is that if by raising mice, for instance, in a virtual reality environment in which you don't have natural images, but you have, say, random patterns, things should not change very much. But if the environment is such that the transformations are unnatural, like you were saying, then, yes, things should change a lot in terms of properties, say, of simple cells. So it's easy to disprove the theory.
Actually, I don't have a question. I have a very quick announcement. We are right now having a session on U.S.-German collaboration in the room at the end of. So you go out this hall and turn left in the poster room. So we welcome people who are already funded by the CRCNS, share your experience with us, and also people who are interested in applying this year. Writing a U.S. application is not trivial. I will be very happy to talk to you. So from both sides, from the U.S. side and the German side, please, we welcome you to join us. We have a little food there, too. So I'm going back there, and I hope to see some of you there. Thank you.
So, Tommy, you talked essentially about visual recognition, object recognition. Can you apply similar principle to other type of visual processing? I don't know, depth, visual flow field, I don't know, whatever else we do, like motor control?
I don't know. I have not thought enough about it. I know that, I think that you can use the same kind of approach for other sensory modalities like sound and probably somatosensory. So I'm especially interested in using a similar approach for audio recognition and particular speech recognition to get essentially a representation that is more invariant to the type of transformation to which speech is exposed, like warping and pitch and so on. But I don't know, we should discuss more later about your question.
Okay, Christoph?
Tommy, can you say something why there are six phase, why Doris and Winrich find six phase patches and why there are five layers of transformation between V1 and AIT?
So I don't know. For the how many cortical areas, I think it's likely there are a different number of cortical areas in different species. And that's part should be due, if you look at the theory, at the level of resolution in which objects can be or should be recognized. So in a sense, in this hierarchical architecture, you want different layers in order to have the ability to recognize parts and full objects. So, and this is related to the size of the visual field and how much resolution there is. So, I don't think it's easy to get an analytic answer to this. We hope to have simulations which will answer that.
Okay. I see no more arms raised. So let's thank Tommy and all the speakers of the session again.